The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap. On today's episode, hosts Elena Youngblood and Colleen Wilmington sit down with NPS's Dean of Students to talk about his leadership takes, his career and academic advice, and his plans and goals for his term here at NPS.
Part one of a two-part series.
Welcome back. I'm Commander Elena Youngblood, and I'm here with Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington, and we are hosts for the Trident Room podcast. And today, we are getting to interview Naval Postgraduate Dean of Students, Captain Eric Skowski. Sir, thank you so much for coming in and sitting with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a great opportunity.
Just to let our listeners know some more about Captain Skowski, he is a Florida native who entered the Navy's delayed entry program in 1985 and served as a machinist mate at submarine base Pearl Harbor. In 1988, he completed basic underwater demolition or SEAL training for Buds Class of 153, officially making him a Navy SEAL. Commissioned as a SEAL limited duty officer in 2002 and becoming an unrestricted line officer in 2012. He served as a part of SEAL Teams 3, 5, and 1, and Task Force Archipelago under Joint Special Operations Task Force Philippines, previously serving as the Operations Officer for Task Unit Trident in Afghanistan and Commander of Special Operations Command Forward Mexico. Captain Skowski has also deployed to the Persian Gulf, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and the Pacific, leading critical missions in support of U.S. strategic objectives. Ashore, he's been positioned at the Defense Language Institute here in Monterey, Naval Special Warfare Unit 8, and Naval Special Warfare Advanced Training Command, serving as Deputy Commander for Commander Task Force 66 in the Europe-Asia region, and Commanding Officer of the Naval Small Craft Instruction and Technical Training Command, where he oversaw training efforts vital to partner nation forces. And his awards include the Silver Star, Legion of Merit, Bronze Star, Defense Meritorious Service Medal, and Meritorious Service Medal 3 awards, among others. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I noted on your bio, thought it was interesting that you mentioned the Navy's delayed entry program. Can you tell us why you chose that route and provide recommendations to those considering that, as it is still an active program?
Well, I would say buyer beware. In August 1985, I finally decided that I needed to get out of my very small town. So I went to the recruiter's office in Panama City, Florida. If you have a pulse and you can take a basic math test. This is in the 80s, mind you, so the height of the Cold War. You were fodder for the nuclear power program. I had both. So I qualified for that, and I was also a submarine volunteer, but I was told I couldn't join until January. So I had to wait that fall into the next year before I started. So it wasn't until just a couple months ago when I was talking to an HR person, human resources, I realized that was all about quotas and numbers and that I could have gone if I had insisted, but they wanted to get 1986 off to a strong start with their recruiting quotas. So they made me wait till January. So I got the boot camp January 3rd from Florida to Great Lakes, sunny Great Lakes. So,
oh, in January.
I was gonna say, what month?
I spent the next 7 months there for A school. And then my bio tells the rest of the story. I didn't go on to Orlando to go to nuclear power school. It was not in the cards. So, but I do appreciate and admire those that do that and then have the capability to make it through that very challenging program.
That's crazy, though, that you've gone your whole career and didn't know that it wasn't intentional.
I never asked the question. It just kind of hit me like, you know what? You know about this stuff. Actually, I was in Millington at a board just last month. And I was there with some recruiting directorate people. And that's when I asked. And then they explained it to me. And I'm like, are you serious? It was that simple. Okay, because I could have been even further along.
Sure.
You know, it worked out the way it's supposed to be. I got to continue to serve. Had I taken another path or a different timeline, who knows?
Yes, you never know, that little linchpin of fate. Well, over your career that we just talked about, what was your most difficult challenge as a leader?
I would say the most challenging was my time in command. So at NAV SCIOTS, or Naval Small Craft Instruction Technical Training School. And the reason being is I was in command from 19 to 21. And of course, that's synonymous with COVID. So that was a challenge to everybody, everywhere, globally. I also had a lot of international students that got stuck because they closed international borders. So I had to find out what to do with my Italians, my Ukrainians, you know, and we didn't have a lot of guidance coming down from higher headquarters because nobody knew how to deal with this. It's been a long time since we've had a pandemic like this. But That aside, I knew I was going to have a challenge having previously served there for 3 years. That command runs on contractors and civil service employees and a lot of active duty military, but we're pretty much three equal parts that it takes to do that mission. And so when I was at Command Leadership School in Newport, Rhode Island, going to the PCO course, I actually took that as my assignment because I knew going into command, having previously served, that this was going to be an issue. Because while everybody is equally necessary to do the mission, when we do things like Christmas parties and Secret Santa or any of those things where foundations pay for things, there's a disparity. Contractors can't come to all the functions that your GS and your active duty can go to. So it was really hard for me to create a sense of equality at the command, and it was outside of my ability to. So what we did is just communicated that we understood and mitigated as much as possible. But I knew that was going to be a challenge, and it was. And some people were very understanding, but there's others that just want to always be mad. That was a great reason. So that was a challenge for me, managing three different cross-sections of exceptional service providers, and then couple that with COVID and the uncertainty of, you know, what was going to happen. So I would say that was my most recent challenging experience.
Okay. Is there a challenge from your past that keeps you up at night still?
It doesn't keep me up at night. And now it's actually one of the best things that have ever happened to me. But as a first class petty officer, I went to captain's mast. And that was extremely painful because, you know, I was a sailor of the quarter. I was like, what do you need to get done? I was a go-to guy. But I was asked to take on so many responsibilities because I was perceived as being able to do everything. I thought, well, they wouldn't be asking me to do this if I wasn't supposed to be able to handle it. And so I eventually failed at something and I had to be held accountable and I let my commanding officer down. And we've talked about it since because he and I were just in my skipper now in his 70s. We were just at a Naval Special Warfare, Virginia High Performance, trying to get healthy again. So we've become pretty good friends, you know, and we talk about it. I really appreciate his leadership, the position that he was in. He had to do what he had to do. I had to pay the consequences. So I received a suspended reduction in rate to E5, came out way stronger than I went in, but it really shaped once I got over the shame of it all, because you don't want to let people down, especially if you sincerely care. But I did, my suspended bust and I went on to do well in the community. You know, clearly here I am still many, many decades later, but I've used that to shape. I look for people making similar errors in judgment, not asking for help when, because they may not realize that it exists.
I was about to say, if you had to sum up the experience as a lesson learned or a professional instance to tell other people, what would that sentence look like?
Don't suffer in silence. Many people say that. You need to ask for help. You need to seek help. People want to help, and they may not know that you need it. So don't be afraid. And I was. I should have just said, hey, I can't do this and this if you have me doing that. So things fell through the crack. But initially, I was kind of too embarrassed to talk about it. And so I would just make help magically appear for people who needed it as a leading petty officer and a chief. I didn't want them to make the same mistakes. But then as I got more comfortable and got over it years later, because it was painful, I started to actually use that as a learning situation and tell them about that. And then unfortunately, I had to have four captain's masts while in command. I didn't want to do a open and humiliating multi-command mast on those four sailors, one of them being a chief. So, but I did bring in my leading petty officers and above because we were a small command, so that they could understand my reasoning, why I decided to do what I did, and so that they could learn without having to go through it themselves. And I also got to share what the sailor standing on the carpet was going through since I had experienced it too. So I just try to use myself as an example.
Speaking of learning from others' mistakes, we have more ensigns coming directly to NPS from their undergraduate schools and heading to the fleet with a master's degree under their belt. But they don't have that fleet experience and rely often on peer-to-peer insight from their senior classmates. What advice would you give them, or what would you tell Ensign Skalski to prepare for that sort of situation?
So peer-to-peer insight is human nature. Folks are going to reach out to those that they feel most comfortable to ask things, but there's a risk that you might be giving bad advice. So recognizing that first and foremost. But also, I will tell them that what a great opportunity that they're here. I mean, academically inclined, they were selected to come here. And there's some timing reasons too, but for the most part, I'm going to say they're all very talented and smart, and they're coming from academia right back into academia. So they're going to knock out things like a graduate degree decades before I will, because I'm still working on that. When they graduate, they're going to go to the fleet more prepared. They're going to be able to think more critically. They're going to have lots of energy. They won't have been beaten down yet by the realities of what it is to serve in a fleet or in any branch of service. all that they learn here is going to serve them very well, but they also need to recognize this is not the real Navy. They've been very, very insulated for a long time. Call it 5 years, if there was 4 years at a service academy, followed by at least a year here. They haven't seen it. And so I'll say manage your expectations. Understand you're going to be frustrated. You're going to be asking the question why, when your leaders may not be able to give you the answer to that. So just be patient. Again, manage expectations. You're going to need to take care of your sailors because they're the ones that run the show. You need to invest in them and take care of them. And you need to choose your mentors very carefully. And then you need to realize that your chiefs have been around a while. And most of them are awesome, but some are better than others. And you need to make sure you choose carefully and exercise good judgment when you're selecting your friends and mentors. And back to that peer-to-peer thing, it may be good advice, but it might not be.
Fair enough. And would this caution in peer-to-peer leadership, choosing of your mentors, would that change if you were giving advice to Petty Officer Skalski?
So you had asked about Ensign Skalski, and I like that you brought it back to Petty Officer Skalski, because when I was a second class, I thought I knew everything. I had reached the internet before the internet even came out. And so now I would just kick my own ass if I ran into Petty Officer Skalski, because that was very self-destructive, no concept of consequences. You know, you're just young and indestructible and think you know it all. And honestly, I think we're in a different time now. We're more zero defect than we were back in the 80s and 90s. So some of the things that we hold ourselves and others accountable for would make our former selves very hypocritical. But different times, different methods. Luckily, I married well. My wife, Carmen, she rescued me from all of that. So I was able to not suffer a potential fate.
Fair enough. And then having led personnel ranging in size, as you said, from a small team to international collaborations, have you seen yourself adapt as a leader?
Absolutely. Especially for my younger self, I was very impatient, thought everybody should be able to do everything. And I didn't understand when people were hurt. This is as a SEAL. I was like, what's their problem? Why can't they do the job? And after I finally started getting hurt, I started realizing that, oh, maybe they were telling the truth. So I've become more patient, appreciative of other people's expertise and experience. So I lean on my staff more. Everybody's heard the saying, do it right or do it twice. So I used to do everything myself. And sometimes I did it twice. And I've stopped jumping to conclusions as quickly. It's easy to jump to conclusions, but the truth always lies somewhere in the middle. Don't believe the first reports. Gather more information and then make a determination. So all those things are examples of what I wouldn't have done as a younger version of myself.
In the variety of the roles that you've held, from receiving the orders to showing up at command, how do you prepare yourself for the mission of that command?
Okay, well, I've only been in command twice.
In all of your roles.
Oh.
I'm going to go be the operations officer. I'm going to go be the CO. How do you prepare to understand that command's role in their mission?
Well, everybody knows you do peer-to-peer collaboration. No, so human nature, you research where you're going. Hopefully you've been exposed to it before. Sometimes you know where you're going. Sometimes it's a big surprise. You may know a year in advance. So I knew a year in advance before I was going into 05 command, but I didn't know I was coming here. When I found out I was coming here, I immediately started getting on the website and reading instructions and kind of really dorking out over everything Naval Postgraduate School. In fact, I really didn't know what a dean was except from what I had seen in movies.
Sure.
So this is not a traditional dean role, mm-hmm. But I guess back to your question, how do you prepare? Basic research, calling the person you're going to relieve. And here's a little bit of advice. I'm always sensitive when I'm calling the person. I'm interested in things like where the hiking trails and the biking routes, although for my listeners, I know I haven't done much of that here. I will, but where a lot of people, I don't have children, but a lot of people ask about the schools and things like that. You don't want to be over communicating about your personal interest. You got to make sure there's a balance in that. Yes, of course you're interested in the job, but you want to learn about the things that are going to actually make you able to do your job. And so, but when I'm asking, especially if I don't know the person and the person doesn't know me, I'm careful to make sure that they don't think that I'm calling for self-serving reasons. I do want to know about the job, but I need to make sure those other human factors things
are there to support you in that.
Exactly. So I would say there's a balance in my interview process when I'm calling someplace where I'm going. I know I'll figure out the job, but I want to know all the stuff outside of the job.
Sounds fair. And then as we shift our discussion to your role here at NPS, how did you prepare to shift from that operational mindset to the educational one? So how did you do that whole process that you were just talked about here for MPS?
Well, academics are still fresh on my mind. I joke that I'm a late bloomer. That's why I'm still only a captain at almost 40 years.
He says only.
I only graduated in 2018 myself. So as a former limited duty officer, that was my undergraduate degree, not my master's degree. I also assume that the role as dean while also being a distance learning student or DL student. So I'm currently experiencing some of the same academic challenges as my classmates. So this is their full-time job. I'm trying to do the same that they're doing with minimal impact to our president's mission. So I try to take classes that are later in the afternoon or on a Friday or something along that lines that supports both my educational goals, but doesn't impact my job as a dean. I do have one thing to add to that, because really the question was, how did I prepare to shift from operational to academic? Well, academic's still fresh in my mind, but I served twice at NAVSCIATS, as I mentioned. And for our listeners that don't know what NAVSCIATS is, that's really Special Operations Command's international schoolhouse. And so I served twice there, both as a training officer and a commanding officer. And while not the same scope or scale as MPS, our goals are the same: provide the best and most relevant education to better prepare our student body for the challenging assignments that lie ahead. And in the case of our NAVSCIATS students, that education was often a matter of life and death. For example, our Ukrainian partners now, and then in the early to mid 2000s, it was our Colombian students with the FARC. So really passionate about academia and the international student mission. And so I'm super happy that we have such a large student body here representing our international students.
As a leader, is there a message that you would like to convey to our listeners, military, civilian, or contractor?
Not to be taken wrong or out of context or anything, but I would say that with 13 academic departments, and a lot of people don't know one another, and with the variance in missions, whether you're teaching or you're doing research or you're just regular staff, which all of it's important, what I see here is there could be more teamwork and communication between the departments. And that's hard to do. I mean, if you put yourself in their shoes and you see what they're doing from day to day, you're like, yeah, where do I have time to collaborate? But I think we would be better off if we found a way to break down some of the communication barriers and helped one another more often. A lot of times it's against your self-interest if you do help someone else. But if you can do that, you'll find out that people will recognize who the team players are, and that will come back to you two or threefold. So I would say try to be a better teammate.
That's great. Thank you so much. Moving into your role as the Dean of Students, like you said, it's not a traditional Dean of Students role. So it's a bit interesting, especially here at MPS, for people that don't know how we're structured. In your words, how does your role differ but complement President Rondeau's role?
So this is kind of an easy one, and my answers will probably be a bit long, but I want to talk to that. So much like my message in this month's Faces of MPS newsletter, and great job, by the way, to our foundation and Alyssa Olson specifically, my role is to leverage my operational experience to foster a high-quality learning environment and ensure student research aligns with future warfighting needs. So I try to bring an informed perspective on what matters to operational commanders while recognizing the pressures and demands our service members face. I'll add to that by saying that I, like everyone on campus, serve at the pleasure of President Rondeau. In support of our mission, which is to provide defense-focused graduate education, and I'll foot stomp, including classified studies and, very importantly, interdisciplinary research to advance the operational effectiveness, technological leadership, and warfighting advantage of the Naval Service, my job, and that of all of us, is to best support the realization of her vision, which is to be the nation's leading institution for defense, higher education, and applied research. And we do that by delivering transformative solutions and innovative leaders for decisive USC power and national defense. So we need to remember why we're here and why and who we serve.
Wow. Okay. I think that message is important. We host a lot of war games here on campus, and some of them struggle for student support, but then the war games themselves advocate for the students, and we understand you have to go to classes. We understand you have coursework. You know, even giving an hour of your time is incredibly useful, because some of those war games actually inform other students' theses. And so finding that balance between coursework and remaining in tune with fleet capabilities, I think the importance about it is highlighted in that message.
I hope so. Thanks.
Are there challenges to leading a command of student warfighters?
Actually, I think it's pretty easy. Everyone here, with the exception of your outliers, everyone here is extremely talented motivated. I think most people are here because they want to be. Some may have, and I mentioned this during my change of command remarks, some people may have been voluntold to come here. I know some people have to. It's part of their career path. Not saying this applies to, for instance, MeTalk. They know they're coming here. So it just depends. But most people want to be here, and it's a pleasure to serve them. And I don't have any, you know, except the human factor challenges. Yeah, we have some disciplinary issues here and there, some poor judgment. But I'd say for the amount of student throughput we have here, that's pretty minimal. I'll just remind, even though we are a student body of civilians, you know, both interagency and otherwise, enlisted and officer, both American and international, I would say that I see more issues with our American officers. Not that there are a lot, but we need to be reminded that we set the example and that before we exercise poor judgment, maybe we ought to just count to three first and realize that we're setting the example and people are watching. As a military officer, you need to be beyond reproach and not always possible, but you need to have that percolate in the back of your mind. So we can and need to be better, but I'd say overall, we're pretty darn good.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.